All right, this is Greek in Plain English, Class 9. We are humming along with this stuff. Tonight we're going to look at infinitives, so you can open your notebooks to that page. Before we do, I wanted to follow up on some work that we did last week. After class, there was an excellent question about the passage that we were studying and why my position was what it was, and that there should be, isn't there an alternate position, and how is that viewed? And that was an excellent question. I want to follow up on that tonight because that's important. What we do here, this is not a theology class. This is certainly not a denominational class. So I don't want this to ever become, you know, here's the point of view of what the Scripture says. Now, granted, in some areas, yes, I'm very comfortable with that, you know, when it comes to the Trinity or, you know, salvation by faith through grace and not of works, those kind of things, divinity of Christ. Those things are, we definitely have to say, yes, this is the definitive answer. But because this class is about learning Greek and the focus is on the text and the exegesis from the text, I wanted to present the alternate argument to what I presented last week because I want you guys to see how we explore the text. And I think that's hugely important to do, that it's not just, well, you know, here's how John did the exegesis, and there you go. Go forth and believe this forever. But you need to look at the other end of this. Now, the passage that we were looking at last week was in John, particularly John 3:16, and it was the use of, because we were studying participles, it was the use of the present participle, hapistuon. And my, just to recap for anybody that forgot from last week, my view is that hapistuon is a present participle. And I said that a present participle, although we normally teach it as continuous action or what I would say would be process action, that in certain cases, particularly the present participle, its verbal aspect is diminished. So the idea of it being continual belief, I don't feel as strong there. I think particularly because it's a present participle, that the grammar of the use of the present participle is I think it's diminished somewhat, and so I said that it just meant sort of a generic idea. It was just those who believe, and it didn't have an emphasis of those who continually believe. Now, there are folks, the other view is then that it does mean continually believe, so that the verbal aspect of the present participle is not diminished here. And so that's really the argument was, do we, and I mean argument in terms of a two different views of something, not an argument like, gosh darn it, you're wrong, I'm going to clonk you on the head or something. Not an argument, but a discussion of two points of view. Mine is that the when we look at instances of the present participle, its continuous aspect is diminished. It's more used in a generic form. And so I want to present the argument for the other side of that, that the present participle is used, particularly in this verse, as a continuous idea, so that it should read those who continually believe. And how I thought the best way to do this, rather than, because you guys heard a whole lot last week of what I thought, is that I would present the argument from another source. This particularly is a guy who I hugely admire. Daniel Wallace is a prophet, Dallas Theological Seminary. The guy is just... he's just a brilliant guy when it comes to Greek. His main work is Greek Grammar Beyond the Basics. This is, you know, I've got a couple of grammars that I spend a whole lot of time in. This is one of them. In fact, I've worn it out. It's literally falling apart on me here. You know, if Dan Wallace ever happens to go to the YouTube channel for Hadavar and he clicks on Evening 9 and he sees that my copy is all worn out, he is welcome to send me a nice fresh copy, mainly with his autograph on the front page. That would be wonderful. But in lieu of that, I will continue to work with my old beat-up copy. Now, Wallace takes a different view of the present participle in this verse than I do. So because he's a man that I greatly admire, and I have to tell you, he's not just an academic. He is a really good, godly man. I mean, sometimes academics have a tendency to only focus on that. And when you read stuff that Wallace has written, it goes beyond that. I mean, he clearly has a pastoral side to what he does. So I really admire this guy. And he's spot on with his scholarship when it comes to Greek. So that's why I think that he is an excellent one to say, I want to present the opposite side to what I think through what he says. Basically, to recap this, we're focusing on the use of the present participle. And the present participle, remember, because I said a participle has part verb and part adjective, it's a verbal adjective, that it's going to have aspects of the verb at the same time as it has aspects of the adjective. And that my view is that particularly the present participle, not other participles, but particularly the present participle, in usages, the verbal side is hugely diminished. It's a very small piece. And so the continuous action idea is flattened out. And so that the present participle becomes, and this is what we would refer to, and Wallace uses this term, I need to define it for us, the idea of gnomic. Now, gnomic has nothing to do with those little red pointy hat things that I have an angel's baseball one out in my garden. It's my little angel's baseball gnome. Mm-hmm. Gnomic is a term that's used in grammar and in the study of language to mean sort of a neutral or timeless idea. In other words, it's something that is not necessarily universal. I think universal is the wrong word here. I think timeless or neutral is the best way to say it. In other words, it's presenting something to say, here's a statement that is always going to be correct. It's gnomic. It's an aphorism. I don't know if you're familiar with that term. And so I believe that the present participle flattens out, diminishes to become fairly gnomic in most of its occurrences in the New Testament. Wallace actually agrees with me to begin with. Wallace, and I don't like to normally read from other people's stuff because you guys don't come here to hear me read to you, but I thought this was the easiest way to do it. Wallace says, and this is in his section on the participle, verbal usage, in my edition, it's page 620. And he says, the aspect of the present participle can be diminished if the particular context requires it. Thus, for example, and he cites the example that I gave last week of Mark 1:4. Habaptizon in Mark 1:4 does not mean the one who continually baptizes, but simply the baptizer, the one who baptizes. And then he points out, also as I did last week, that we can verify that by, if we look at Mark 6:14, and we read that, it says, John the baptizer has been raised from the dead. Well, if it means that he's continually baptizing, then it would sort of have this ridiculous picture of like the, not the headless horseman, but the headless baptizer at that point, because John had been deceased. So Wallace presents the same point that I do, that the present participle can be diminished, can be flattened out to be non-continual action, just simply be gnomic in its course. He has a footnote to this that says this is not as common with participles in other tenses. The reason seems to be that the present participle is well suited to a generic notion, that was the word I was looking for, generic, leading itself to a gnomic tense use. The other tenses, however, are usually more specific in their application, so that's why they don't flatten out quite like the present participle does. At that point, Wallace and I completely agree. I'm not going to end there, though, because we do disagree at one point here. So he gives further illustrations, not all with the present participle, but Mark 6:44, those who ate the loaves were 5,000 men. The idea of continually eating, but again, we're not dealing with necessarily with the same construction as we see in the other one. In Luke 1:45, blessed is she who believed. So again, we have this idea of the participle being the aspect of the participle not focusing on continual action. And then he gives an example in John 4:13, everyone who drinks. And his comment on this, it may be that the evangelist does have a habitual ideal in mind, someone who's continually drinking. But in this case, the present participle is contracted with the aorist subjunctive of the following verse, as if to say everyone who continually drinks, but whoever should taste. So he thinks that in this particular case, it has both nomic, flattened out, non-habitual, along with continual action. And that's where he comes down on the side of the passage we looked at last week, John 3:16, about everyone who believes. And Wallace's position on that verse, which again is different than mine, is the idea seems to be both nomic and continual. Everyone who continually believes at the same time as everyone who believes. So he sees it as shading both ways. He says, this is not due only to the present tense, because just above it, he described that the present tense would be only nomic. But he says that the present part, use of the present participle of pistuo, especially in soteriological context in the New Testament. So what Wallace says is the thing that makes John 3:16 different than the passages we looked at in Luke about divorce, the other passages that Wallace himself cites in Mark about John the Baptist, the 1 Thessalonian passage, again, that Wallace and I both agree on about Jesus delivering. He says, what makes this John 3:16 passage different is that it's soteriological in context. Now, that word soteriological just has to do with salvation. Okay, the word in Greek for to save is sozo. That's the verb. And so when you're in seminary and you're studying about salvation, all the things you study are all ologies. And you take the Greek word and you slam ology onto the end of it, so you get soteriology, which means to study about saving. Just like the study of God is theology. It's theos plus ology. He says that particularly where this changes is that in passages related to salvation or to soteriology, Wallace believes that the grammar itself then shifts. And so that this idea of a present participle being flattened out, meaning just a generic term, and not meaning continually, that doesn't apply in passages that are focusing on salvation. So that's Wallace's first point. He makes a distinction there. I don't make that distinction. Wallace does. And then he goes on, his second point that he makes is that there's a difference between which form of the participle is used. And he says that there are both, in these salvation passages, there are some that use the aorist participle and some that use the present participle. If you remember what I taught about participles last week, was that they have different aspects depending on what their tense is. That a present participle is normally going to be continual action, a process action, whereas the aorist participle is going to be event or undefined action. So Wallace says, particularly in passages that relate to salvation, the Gospels use the New Testament uses two different participles, forms of this verb to believe, right? One is the aorist, one is the present. And he did a statistical count. And he said that the aorist form of the participle, so that would be pistousos, the aorist form, is used 8 times. The present tense form, the one that's used in our target passage, John 3:16, pistuon, is used 43 times. So, first of all, he makes a statement that within salvation passages, this word pistuon, using the word believe, the participle, that there are 6 usages of the aorist And there's, how many times is that? There's six times more, 43 usages of the present participle. So then his point in all of this, his statement then, is it seems that, according to Wallace, since the aorist participle was an option to describe a believer, a generic kind of gnomic idea, he says that since that was available, when an author in the New Testament used the present tense, he really wanted to say continual, not just generic. Does that, you see what Wallace is saying there? That because there are these two usages, in soteriological passage, in salvation passages, that the author had a choice. And if he used one and not the other, Wallace believes they did that intentionally to show continual activity, in this case, continual belief. So then Wallace goes on to finish this up, to say it is unlikely that when the present tense was used, it was flat or generic. Now again, Wallace agrees that it's that way in every other section of the New Testament. It's only in these passages that talk about salvation does Wallace believe that it is used differently. Okay, so that's his criteria, his shift there. And that's a major difference between what I believe and what Wallace believes. He says, the present was the tense of choice, most likely because the New Testament writers, by and large, saw continual belief as a necessary condition for salvation. So Wallace's idea that the grammar changes in salvation passages is that there's two different ways we could talk about belief or believers as either generic believers or continual believers. And that the reason why this is because he believes that the New Testament authors believed that continual belief was necessary for salvation. So Wallace is making a statement about the theological position of the New Testament authors, that they believed that continual belief was necessary for salvation. So that's why in these salvation passages, the grammar shifted from what it does in the other passages to be this continual use of the present tense. And then he goes on to say that this occurs in almost all of these passages. He quotes 50-some passages here that relate to this. But he does say there are exceptions. There are times where the aorist tense, which he says is generic, is actually used in the way that the present tense is used. So Wallace's view of this then is, again, his exegetical view is that here's how the present tense operates most of the time in these participles. But in these passages, in salvation passages, there's sort of a shift in the grammar and how it's used. And that's because of how the authors viewed the need to portray continual belief as necessary for salvation. So that's what Wallace presents. My view last week is different than that. I stop at the point where Wallace makes his grammar shift. I'm just uncomfortable with that personally. My view of language is that there is no shift. Wallace believes that based on the evidence in the text, there is a grammar shift, because he believes that the writers of the New Testament viewed continual belief as necessary for salvation. So you can see that what we have then are two different views of how we approach this, of what we think this text means. Okay, so how does that all pan out? Like I said, I have huge respect for Wallace. I mean, the fact that I disagree with him says nothing about my admiration for him. I just disagree in this particular position. The guy is excellent. His Greek is spotless. He is a good, godly man outside of the academic thing. It's not like he's some wild liberal scholar. So what you have, and I like to think, on the other hand, that I'm a pretty decent guy too, that I'm a good believer, and that I'm theologically orthodox as well. But Wallace and I approach this same text differently. What's important for you to see is not the outcome. Okay, that's whether you take it as there's a need for continual belief for salvation or the need of, or it's just simply that you believe in and salvation, this text, without continual action, that's for a class other than this. That's for a theology class. And I am not a theologian. That's not where I operate. What you need to see is how both Wallace and I, and not just me, I mean, there are a lot of folks that hold my position as well. I'm not some sort of, you know, here's me versus everybody else. Those who hold my position, those who hold Wallace's position, how we approach the text. That's the important thing. That's what this class is trying to show. How do folks who believe in the inerrancy of the text, who believe in the necessity to draw our theology from the text, not study the text in light of what we already think we know, how do we approach the text? And you can see that Wallace and I take two different views. And I don't mean to say that the outcome doesn't matter, but what's important for what I'm trying to teach in this class is the process. It's that you seriously approach the text and that you validate what you say the text says. I showed my validation tonight. I read Wallace's validation of his position. We can then discuss that, and we can, and there should be discussion. You know, if Wallace was here, I'd say, well, you know, boy, did you look at this and this? And he'd probably say, oh yeah, but did you look at this, this, and this? You know, we'd sort of talk to each other about how we validate our process. But the point is that it is a process. We're Wallace and myself, we're both going into the text to say, what does the text say here? Because that's ultimately the most important thing. And again, the role of theology then is to take what you get in the text and to say, okay, now this is what it means, you know, for, you know, folks who show up on Sunday. This is what it means for believers. This is what the, but you have to have what the text says first. And the way you do that is what I do, what Wallace has done, what anybody who seriously interacts with the text does. You decide, you know, you look at it, you work through it almost in what would be a I don't like this term, but a scientific manner. You systematically work through the text. You use the laws of grammar and the rules of linguistics and whatnot to attain this. And Wallace and I have both done that. We just have come up with two different positions on it. What happens often is that then folks cherry pick what they want to use to make their theology. They, I believe this is true. Oh, Wallace agrees with that. Well, I'm going to pick him. And then something else, they go, oh, I believe this is true. Oh, John agrees with that. Oh, I'm going to pick him. And that's kind of unfair to me and to anybody, and Wallace in this case, because you know we take this work seriously, and it's not, you don't get to cherry pick this stuff, you know? But I also want you to see is that it's possible to seriously interact with the text and come up with a different view. Okay? I mean, that is completely possible. Now, I hold completely to my view. I've held that view for a number of years. I believe that I've effectively validated it, and I would welcome questions about that validation process completely. I would suspect if Wallace was here, he'd say the exact same thing I just said. So, again, you reach a situation. Now, honestly, this particular passage doesn't have huge ramifications. It's not like, you know, he's saying that the Trinity is the Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and I'm saying, you know, there's three other guys in the Trinity, you know, so there's six people. This is not something like that. Here we both agree that the text says that you have to believe in Christ to have eternal life. We're not arguing that. We're just simply talking about, well, what does that belief look like? What does the text say about the mechanics of that belief? And again, we're going to look at it differently. Wallace comes, I know, from a slightly different theological position than I do, so I understand that while I have a tendency to shade closer to my theological position, Wallace will always shade closer to his. That's just human nature. I think it's almost impossible. I don't think I could convincingly argue for a theological position that is opposite of mine. Just because I think my theological position is correct, because I've done a lot of work to get there. And I wouldn't expect someone who held a different view than mine to be able to convincingly argue my side of the thing. In this case, though, this isn't a major issue. This is a secondary issue. The major issue of salvation through Christ, through believing in Christ, is the key issue that Wallace and I both absolutely agree on. And this verse doesn't change that at all. But you need to see how two different people work through the text and come up with the views. Mine is that it's flattened out. It just means it's a generic term for believers, everyone who believes. Wallace believes that it's everyone who continually believes. And so that we both approach with a difference. But I felt it important to bring Wallace's point of view in tonight so that it wasn't just the John show last week of my view alone. And the question after class was hugely helpful in showing me that I needed to do that. So I really valued that sort of interaction. It for anybody watching on the internet or seeing this at YouTube, that question was asked after the tape was off. So if you go to last week's class and cursor through it, you won't find that question. It was after the tape was over. But I felt that it was necessary tonight to present the opposite side of that argument, because I want you to see how folks approach the text but come away with slightly different views. I hugely recommend Wallace. He's involved a lot with a website called Bible.org. And it's a wonderful website, and you can click on there, and there are all these essays and things that have been written that are just wonderful. And you can go click on Wallace, and you'll just see a list of everything he's written. And the guy's just amazing. I mean, his output is huge. I would, if I even wrote a grammar half this good, I would call it my life's work and retire at that point. And he cranked this sucker out at an age younger than I am now and is still teaching and doing all this stuff. So Wallace is an amazing guy. And that's why I chose his argument, because I felt you can't pick apart his Greek skills because they're that good. So that's why it was important to see the opposite argument from someone who I really admire a quality of his scholarly work on this. So that's anyway. So that's what I wanted to do tonight. I wanted to sort of do a little catch-up work from last week on that. I think I covered everything. I want to be fair and show Wallace's position accurately. That's why I read from the text of his stuff. I think I was fairly, in fact, if anything, slightly too long-winded last week in presenting my view of the passage. So anyway, those are the two views of John 3:16 of the present participle there. Now you can see why I said when we started studying participles that they're hugely flexible. And they're hard to understand sometimes. You got to do a lot of work with them. And you can see in this case that a lot of work has been done with this particular thing. And it's still not, okay, here's the definitive answer that everybody should tie into. So, okay. Infinitives. We're going to start infinitives this week. I said last week, 2 weeks ago, whenever we first looked at participles, that participles were verbal adjatives. And they were like part verbs, part adjective, and that those things that were verbal and those things that were adjectival were combined together in these incredibly flexible kind of words. This week we're going to study infinitives. Now, infinitives are verbal nouns. Participles are verbal adjectives. Infinitives are verbal nouns. Most of us know infinitives for two things. One, we always know that an infinitive begins with the word to. T-O, okay? To teach, to learn, to swim, to eat. Those are all infinitives in English. And we were always taught that we must never split an infinitive. And most of us went, okay, I won't do it because I don't know what that means. The best example I could think of to show you what a split infinitive is one of the most famous split infinitives ever in the history of mankind, okay? To boldly go where no man has, right? You get, okay, that's a split infinitive. A split infinitive is where you take the word to and the verb go, and you stick a word in between them, or any verb. So in this case, the infinitive is to go. Captain Kirk, to go, right? But Captain Kirk was just so fired up about his star mandate that he split his infinitive. To boldly go. I am told nowadays that grammarians are lighting up on that, that apparently my high school English teacher was wrong to hit me about the knuckles with a ruler every time I split an infinitive, and that nowadays we're a little bit looser on that. I'm still uncomfortable with splitting infinitives, except in a case of such a profound statement as to boldly go where no man had gone. That one I think is fine. We should just leave that one alone. The thing about Greek infinitives is you can't split them because they're just one word. See, an English infinitive has two words. It's got the word to and it's got the verb in there. Greek infinitives are just simply one word. So you will be lucky now, studying Greek infinitives, to know there's no possibility that you can split the Greek infinitive. Of course, you can't always split it when you translate it into English, if you would like. But the Greek words themselves, infinitives, you can't split. And Greek infinitives, then, are verbal nouns. Now, that word in infinitive, okay, it means exactly what it sounds like. You know the word infinitive, okay, means infinite, has no limit on it. You see, in grammar, you talk about finite verbs. Okay, those are verbs that have a limit on them. And then you talk about infinitives. Well, those are verbs that don't have a limit. The way they're limited is usually a finite verb will have a subject. Okay? If I say, our good friend Tom that we've talked about through the whole class, if I say, Tom hit the ball, okay, hit is a finite verb, okay, it's limited. It's limited to, by Tom, the subject, right? So a finite verb has a subject, Tom hit the ball. If I were to form our verb hit into an infinitive, it would no longer be limited, it would be unlimited, because to take the verb hit and make it an infinitive, I say, to hit the ball. To hit the ball. Sounds very poetic, right? Like a beginning of a baseball poem. To hit the ball, it's not limited. It's not limited to Tom. It's limited nowhere. It just talks about hitting the ball. So you can see, by its nature, an infinitive has sort of a broader range than a finite verb. Anybody tracking with that? Got that? Okay. Okay, so it's this idea of subject. Now, because of this, we also have to realize that infinitives don't have time. Right? To hit, when I say Tom hit the ball, that kind of tells me there's a time aspect in there of that verb, right? We know verbs all have time aspect in them. And in this case, the infinitive, to hit the ball, it's timeless. There is no time associated with it. Infinitives in Greek have tense, but they have no time. Let me say that again. Infinitives in Greek have tense, but they have no time. Now, you'll see in a minute, they get their time from someplace else. But in and of themselves, their little infinitive DNA does not have a little spiral that's time. Okay, they are without the gene of time in their little DNA makeup. Okay, they have tense. Infinitives in Koine Greek occur in three tenses. Okay, the present, the aorist, and the perfect. And since we've talked about these tenses over and over and over again for, I think, 4 weeks now, maybe 5 weeks, you guys probably already know this, but I'll say it again. Present tense, again, this is not time, this is aspect. Present tense is process or continual, as we've just spent a lot of time talking about continual, right? Aorist tense is undefined or event, and perfect tense is completed. So whether it's present, aorist, or perfect as an infinitive tells you about the quality of the action, the aspect of the action, not the time. Is the action process? Is the action event? Is the action completed? So infinitives, a present infinitive will talk about some sort of action that's in process. An aorist infinitive will tell you simply a statement that something occurred, the action occurred. And the perfect tense will tell you that the idea of the infinitive in the perfect tense is that it's completed action. Okay? This is frequently something that is really difficult for folks to get about Greek. And I know I spend a lot of time, week after week, I kind of mention this a lot. And it's not because I enjoy being redundant. I sometimes do that out of memory lapse, but not intentionally. But in this case, it's important to do this because I've taught Greek for years, and you kind of pick up on what people get and what they don't get. And one of the things that they struggle to get sometimes is this idea of aspect versus time. Because in English, we don't usually talk about the type of action, we talk about the time of action. We're more concerned, I'm eating, I have eaten, I will eat, than we are about how we eat. Did I eat quickly? Did I just scarf it down and run out? Did I have a lavish banquet that was 12 courses that took me 3 hours to eat? You know, we don't usually care about that stuff. We just want to know when we ate, right? We're doing it now. Did we do it in the past? Are we going to do it in the future? So in Greek, though, the idea that this action can be a process or an event or completed, that's what's dominant in the Greek idea, especially in infinitives. And you need to start being sensitive to that. That's a question that you want to start asking the text when you see an action word. What kind of action is this? I'll talk about this later on in a couple of weeks when we look at how to study the text based on what we know. But I, sort of as a side note, if this was a USA Today a newspaper, this would be a little colored patch on the side, probably with a pie chart, what I'm going to tell you now. You have to ask questions of the text, okay? When you see a verb or something that's verbal in nature, a verb, a participle, an infinitive, you need to ask, well, what about it? What type of action are you talking about here? Hey, Paul, what are you trying to tell me with this verb? Okay? Hey, Mark, Luke, whoever's writing that, what are you telling me with this action? And I already, a few weeks ago, I talked about this. Even when we put a label on it and we say, oh, well, that's continuous action. I like process better, again, because it doesn't have the sort of lexical predefinitions that continuous does. But if I say continual action, then you need to ask another question of the text. Well, what kind of continuous action? And I'm using continuous because we just talked about that earlier. If I turn the spigot on outside my back door, water's going to flow out. Okay? Or if you turn the faucet on there in your kitchen or your bathroom, the water comes out. That water is flowing continuously. If your plumbing's good, it never stops until you close the faucet, right? So that's one type of continuous action. Earlier before class, we were bemoaning Southern California traffic. Now, I can say that I drove continuously for 3 hours. Okay, that's true. I got in my car at, you know, noon, and I didn't get out of my car till 3 o'clock. But in reality, I probably didn't drive continuously, especially in Southern California, for that amount of time. I probably drove pretty good for a while, and then I probably stopped. And then the traffic slowed down at the interchange, and so I only drove 5 miles an hour, and then I stopped. And I had to wait a minute because they cleared an accident. And then I drove 50 miles an hour, and then I came to another traffic jam, and I stopped. So there's continual driving. I'm driving from noon till 3, but in that process, I'm not driving in the same way the water's coming out of the faucet of your sink. I can say that I've studied Greek. I should do the math on this one of these days. If you guys are good with math, I started studying Greek, I don't know, around 1977, 78, something like that. And this is now 2013. So whatever that, however long that is, I continually studied Greek. It doesn't mean that every hour of every day. I slept, I took vacations. There were days I never even opened my Greek grammar up, okay? So, but I've continually studied the language. That's even more sporadic than the driving, and it's certainly different than the water flowing out of the tap. There's an idea of continuous action as iterative. It's a pulse. It's a continuous action with breaks in between. I grew up with a cuckoo clock in my house. I don't know if you've ever had the joy of a cuckoo clock in your house, but you know that they do not allow you to forget that the time happens, okay? Because every hour, the little cuckoo would come out and go, boop, 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 you know, depending on what hour it was, right? That clock was continuous in that it chimed every hour. Not all the time, but every hour, that little bird stuck its little wooden beak out and went, boop, 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 right? That's iterative action. So that's another type of continuous action. So the questions that you ask the text then are, what kind of action is this? And if the text answers you back, it's continuous action, okay, then you say, aha, what type of continuous action? So you see, you need to ask the text these questions. Okay, and you may not be asking the text, you may be looking for these answers in a commentary, or you may be listening for it in a sermon. I'm using the idea of asking the text as a metaphor. I hope your text doesn't talk back to you. If it does, you may want to seek counseling at some point. But so I'm saying that we need to ask these questions. These are the kind of things that we do. Okay, jump back now back to our infinitives. Now back to our regularly scheduled infinitive. So the way that we get time for infinitives then is the infinitive will have a it'll have a verb, or it'll have something around it that'll have time. Normally it's a finite verb. An infinitive will have a finite verb. So whatever the time of the finite verb is, that gives us the time for our infinitive. So if I say, the student studied, and then I throw in the infinitive, to learn Greek. Okay? So my to learn Greek has no time. Okay? It's just there. But it gets its time from the finite verb in that sentence. The students studied. It's a past tense verb for us in English, right? So the infinitive would have the concept of past tense time, because that verb that I used, the students studied to learn Greek. If I say the students are studying to learn Greek, now it has a present tense feel to it, right? And because I'm using an English participle there, it has a continuous feel to it. So that same infinitive, to learn Greek, now has a present tense feel. The students are studying to learn Greek. You see how this is going? If I want to give it a future tense feel, I would say the students will study to learn Greek. There, it's a future tense idea, right? They will study. They're not studying right now, they're watching the ball game, but they will study at some point. And then my infinitive, to learn Greek. So our infinitives will take their time from the finite verb that they're associated with. Does that make sense? Okay. Along with tense, infinitives also have voice. And voice, again, is the same thing, whether it's a verb, a participle, or infinitive. Voice is always going to be a present, active, passive, or middle. And remember, just quick recap on what voice is. Voice is the relationship of the person, of the verb, the subject of the verb, to the action. So an active voice is the subject of the verb is doing the action. Passive voice is the subject of the verb is receiving the action. And middle voice is the subject of the verb is somehow both creating the action and participating in the result of the action. Not necessarily hitting themselves, but they're receiving the result in some manner. So on the verbal side, infinitives, verbal nouns, have tense, not time, right? They have aspect, and they have voice. And where they get their time, because they don't have time, their little infinitive DNA doesn't have any time associated with it, they get their time from the finite verb that they're with. On the noun side, there's nothing. Okay? Remember, the participle had those noun things in there. It could be a case, and it could be gender, and it could be number, right, for participles, because they were verbal adjectives. Well, infinitives is verbal nouns. They get nothing from the noun side. The reason why is they're called indeclinable. Not like the old song by Lou Rawls, Unforgettable, or Nat King Cole, if you go back further than Lou Rawls. But they're indeclinable. In other words, the form never changes. Remember that forms changed on nouns, right? They declined, they changed, because they had to show us their function in the sentence. Okay? Infinitives are indeclinable. They don't have to show us their function. They get their function from those things that are around them, and in some cases, with particular usages. Normally, they get that from the article. Because they're a verbal noun, they can take the article. And so they'll get their case from that article, but in and of themselves. And this was the point in first year grammar that most of the students went, oh, whew, thank goodness, because it's a lot easier to memorize the paradigm for an indeclinable element of speech than it is one that has 36 different forms, you know. So everybody always liked infinitives for that case. Okay, how are infinitives used? Infinitives used first of all is substantive, the noun side of the verbal noun idea, right? Which means they can perform just about any function that a noun can. Okay. Most of the time. We'll know that it's functioning in that way because it'll have the article in front of it. Remember I said when we talked about the article that was hugely important in some areas to tell us what was going on? It helps us to know what the case of those ugly third declension nouns that nobody can ever figure out. That's the easy way to get it. In this case, it helps us to tell the function of the infinitive when it's functioning as a substantive. Now, the interesting thing is, in this case, the article that it uses will always be the neuter singular. Okay? It never will take a masculine article. It will never take a feminine article. It only takes the neuter, and it only takes the singular. So when you have a, now it may take a different case. It may be in the accusative or the nominative, but it will only be, gender will be neuter and number will be singular, the articles that are attached to infinitives. And this is when it's used as a substantive, which means it's used as a subject. A good example, well, I've got one in your notes. To learn is good. Okay, to learn is the subject there. We could say that a different way in English. We could say learning is good, right? It would still be the same function, but I had to give you an example that used an infinitive, so we said to learn is good. Which, by the way, that is a gnomic expression. That's a universal aphorism. It is always good to learn. So that's as well. Okay, now the next thing that it does, that's the noun side. It's a substantive. It functions as a noun would, as a subject. Now the other thing is when we play up the verbal side, okay? And that's what we call a complementary infinitive. A complementary infinitive means that it adds something, it complements the verb. It says, hello, Mr. Verb, you're looking quite nice today. I like those slacks you're wearing. It's a complementary infinitive, okay? Now, with an infinitive can be built off of any verb, just like a participle could be built off of any verb. But there are some verbs, five in particular, that always take a complementary infinitive. And I wrote those on the board for your viewing pleasure. And these will make sense. See, that's the thing about language. I remember I said the very opening night of this class, I said language is all about communication. And so there's a lot of just common sense stuff in language that grammarians spend a whole lot of time forming rules and writing big books about that are just common sense, right? Well, these five verbs, it makes sense that they need a complementary infinitive because in and of themselves, they don't tell us enough. The first one is day. Okay? It means necessary. Necessary to what? Right? Necessary to, it is necessary to learn Greek if you want to be a scholar. Right? So necessary needs that complementary infinitive. Existen. It is lawful or it is right. Well, it's lawful or right to do what? Right? It's lawful to go to the temple and offer a grain sacrifice if you're a first century Jewish guy living in Jerusalem. Mellow, not like mellow like you are at the end of the evening watching the TV late at night. Mellow, I am about to, and then our infinitive. I'm about to teach, I'm about to learn, I'm about to eat, whatever our infinitive of choice there. I used to do this and I'd always say to eat on there, but then people, I think, thought I was obsessing about food, so I tried to change it up so no one will get a wrong opinion. Dunamai, okay, I am able. I'm able, what am I able? I'm able to fill in the infinitive. Dunamai. This is one of my favorite verbs in Greek, and I tell you this, I am intentionally mocking anyone that does this, okay? I hate this when this happens. Because in language, we borrow words back and forth, and we sometimes make up words using older words, okay? In English, we have a word for an explosive called dynamite, okay? That word is not found in ancient Koine Greek, okay? That's an English word that we made using dunamai, this Greek word, right? It's dynamite, okay? So it's a modern word that has this little Greek sound to it because we borrowed from Greek to make the word, right? I'm not lying to you. I have actually heard this said, unfortunately, from someone teaching a congregation. Well, you know, the Greek word there is dunamai. Dunamai is like our modern word dynamite. So what the text is saying is this is explosive. Okay, that's not, I mean, I even had to do my funny TV announcer voice to do that, right? That's terrible. Never do that, okay? Dynamite is a modern word. It's a great word. And if you can use it to explain the text, then use it to explain the text. But don't look at the Greek word that was thousands of years old, wasn't part of this word, and try to say that it has any connection, because it just doesn't. You know, we just don't do that, okay? So dunamai is one of these five verbs that has to have a complementary infinitive. I am able. I am able to what? To fill in your infinitive. Archomai is another one. I am beginning. Okay, what are you beginning? Am I beginning to read, to write, to laugh, to dance? What am I beginning, right? I'm beginning to sing. I'm beginning to paint. So these five verbs will always take a complementary infinitive. The other verbs do as well, but I'm just saying these five are always going to take that complementary infinitive. Okay. Now, in your notes, on the page that has complementary infinitives on there, also has a section called infinitives with prepositions. Okay, sometimes an infinitive is used with a preposition to tell us specifically, it's a grammatical marker. Remember how I said that when authors wrote the Greek, they intentionally did things grammatically to tell us where they were going, what they meant. See, nowadays, if I take my nice gold-edged modern Bible with its fake leather cover and I open it up and I look in all these different sections, they've got numbers, and it's chapter 21, verse 20, and it's got a heading, and it says, this is where Peter and the disciple Jesus loved, and right, and I've got all this stuff in here. And what we think is that, wow, that must have been so cool that, when Jesus was explaining the scriptures to the disciples after he was risen, it was nice because he opened his leather, gold-edged, thumb-indexed Bible and took the ribbon out and said, okay, boys, turn to Exodus 20. I'm going to walk you through this. Well, that wasn't the case, right? Back then, this stuff, the Old Testament was written on scrolls. I believe most of the New Testament, if not all of the New Testament, was written on scrolls as well. I don't think that they had codices at the time of the writing of the New Testament. And a codices is a fancy scholarly name for a book, right? Because the technology, I'm going to mildly get off track for a second here. One of the great technological inventions of humankind was the switch from the scroll to a codices. Okay, a scroll, you were limited. Because if you wrote on animal skin, you were limited by the size of the animal skin. I mean, unless you could find a woolly mammoth, most of your animals were going to be only so big, and by the time you scrape the fur and the guts off of it, and you tan it and thin it out and everything, you can only get, this much stuff to write on, right? And then you roll it up, okay? And while that was really good, because that was a lot better than stone tablets, right? Because, you couldn't carry around a 5-ton stone tablet, you could carry around this scroll of animal hide, of vellum, and that was pretty good. So that was a big jump there. But the problem with scrolls was that they were rolled up. See, if I'm studying the Bible and I say, okay, you guys, go over here in Joshua, and now keep your finger there and jump over here to 1 Corinthians, I can do that, right? If I've got a scroll, and I'm at the front part of the scroll, and I go, okay, oh, shoot, you need to turn to chapter 20, I got to unravel that scroll real quick. And this other end's curled up on me, right? Normally they were on rollers, right? So I couldn't hold two places at once. So there were drawbacks to the scroll. Codices comes along, huge invention, because now I write on flat pieces of papyrus, right? I don't have to worry about killing big animals. I just go out in the swamp and I cut this bush down and I go pound it out and I take the reeds and I lay them overlapping each other. And now I've created, once it dries out, this piece of paper that I can write on. And now I can have as many of these as I want. And I just stack them together and I clip them on one side. And I can write on both sides of them if I want to, right? And because scroll, you only wrote on one side. And then I could do my magic trick of jumping to two different places just by keeping my finger, right? So a codices was huge in terms of a technological leap forward. I believe that the scroll to the codices was sort of akin to going when the internet came in, right? Because, I mean, it's a huge technological event. I know we don't think that nowadays, because nowadays books are old hat when you have Kindle or an iPad. But in the first century, it was a big deal. Okay, I got way off track there. This stuff was originally written, I believe, on scrolls. And it was written all capital letters with no spaces. And so you had to tell the reader, look it, this is where I'm going, right? We didn't have chapter and verse numbers. We didn't have, so the way you tell somebody, here's where my argument is going. There's A, B, and C. The result of A, B, and C is now D. Well, I have to have something there to tell you I'm at the result part of this. And the way I do that is grammatically. And if you look in your book, one of the ways we do this is by using infinitives with prepositions. Now, you'll see there are six prepositions there. Dia, ice, pros, pra, en, and meta. Okay, those are the six prepositions that when used with an infinitive will give us a certain thing. Now, what I want you to do is sort of take, well, you can do as you like. My recommendation is mark sort of a dotted line across the page between pros and pra, because these really separate into two sections. We have result or purpose, and then we have time, and it separates there between the two. Dia, ice, and pros are all showing us either result or purpose. And honestly, in result and purpose sometimes overlaps. So those two go together real well. I did this because of, or I did this in order that. I did this as a result, or I did this for this purpose. They're real close, okay? And then the bottom three, pra, en, and meta, are all time related. Okay, now, if I have dia plus an infinitive, it's going to give me result. So what I would translate that into English, and I'd recommend you sort of scroll these in there because I didn't, is the word because. Dia plus an infinitive gives us the idea of result. In other words, because. Because of this stuff, this other stuff. Ice plus the infinitive gives us purpose. So in order that. And the same thing for pros plus the infinitive gives us purpose, so I would write in order that. So that when you see the word because, or you see the phrase in order that, that's the best way to translate the idea of what's going on with these prepositions and these infinitives. Now there are three that relate to time. Pra plus the infinitive tells us before. En plus the infinitive tells us while. That's also, by the way, it's also when. So you can put a slash there and say while or when. And then meta plus the infinitive gives us after. So these six uses of the infinitive for these prepositions give us very specific grammatical markers so that they tell us what's going on in the text. This is important, not so much in the Gospels. The Gospels are pretty much straightforward historical narrative. I mean, they have different things in them. They have some poetry. They have parables in them. But in general, even the parables have the idea of narrative time, right? They start here. They go to here. Linear time. The epistles, the letters, Romans, that's a philosophical argument, okay? And that's different than Jesus woke up, ate some fish, and went to Capernaum with the boys, okay? That's a chronological historical narrative. Paul explaining the law in Israel and believers, that's a philosophical argument. You need these markers in a philosophical argument, especially in Paul. And I'm just not saying that Paul's difficult because I think he is. It is inerrant scripture that Paul is difficult. Peter tells us that those things that Paul writes are equal with Old Testament scripture, but they're really hard to understand, right? So the Bible itself even says that Paul is kind of tough to wade through occasionally. So we need to look at these infinitives with prepositions as occasionally as grammatical markers to help us understand where the argument is going. How does this apply to you guys? Well, if you're reading a commentary or hearing someone preach and they say, well, what Paul is trying to say here is that because of this stuff, we have this other stuff, and we know that because Paul uses dia plus an infinitive. Well, you're right. Cool. So see, now you guys know what that means. Okay, the other thing that we get is we do get purpose with an infinitive, and that's an infinitive used with the word hoste. Okay, that's in your notes. Hoste is with that word, hoste. And when we see the infinitive with hoste, we know that it's talking about actually result, purpose and result overlap. When we see an infinitive with the article in the genitive case, we would think that that means purpose or result as well. Now, I have this one cryptic sentence in here when I was preparing for tonight, and I know this may shock you that I actually do prepare to come in here. I don't just walk in the door and make this up. I looked at my notes and I went, well, that makes no sense at all, because it says the infinitive alone with no article can mean this. Well, sure, it can mean a whole lot of stuff without the article, and I said context will help here. So you may want to just scratch that out. That's kind of a ridiculous. I don't know why I wrote that to begin with. It's true that the infinitive without the article can be purpose or result, but it can be a whole bunch of other stuff, so that it just seemed weird to have it there in the notes. So you can see that infinitives then are pretty flexible. They're flexible like participles, not quite with the range of participles, but they can be flexible, and they can do important things when they're used with prepositions to tell us purpose or result or time. Is it before, during, or after? Remember about infinitives. They're indeclinable, so they won't have different forms. They have no time, only aspect. They get their time from the finite verb that they're with, okay? And they can be used as a subject, they can be used as a complement, or they can be used to show purpose or result. Okay? All right, that's everything you need to know about infinitives. Next week we're going to start looking at clausal grammar. Boy, that makes it sound pretty impressive, huh? It's just, what we've been studying up to this point are individual word things. And next week we're going to look at putting all these words together. So it's sort of like, you know, when you learn words, you learn nouns and verbs and stuff like that, and then you finally get to write a sentence with them. That's what we're going to look at starting next week, clausal grammar. Okay? Any questions? All right. I will see you all next week.